call this meeting to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:02 on Thursday, March 26th. Welcome to the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. Present Representative Hughes, Representative Tuck, Representative Ledoux. I see that Representative Wynn will be joining us, as well as Representative Bloomberg was here. So myself, Chair Herron. The only item of business today is House Bill 126, Code of Military Justice. It's my intent to discuss, hear testimony and discuss this legislation, and then hold it to the next meeting, where it will be my intent to move it on to the next committee referral. We do have HB 126, and I would like to acknowledge that Representative Tuck and Representative Ledoux are going to work on this together, and we appreciate Representative Tuck and his staff for their significant contribution to this CS, which I would ask my vice chair to move for discussion purposes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move HB 120 CS for HB 126 version H for purposes of discussion.
And I will object for that discussion. And so, Representative Ledoux,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just a point of parliamentary procedure. If you're going to be leaving shortly, maybe somebody else ought to object so they can remove their objection, which you couldn't do if you're not here.
Note for the record that Representative Bloomberg has objected.
So we're not going to be able to remove the objection if we want to.
No, you're the one that objected.
I see. Oh, yeah, thank you. I didn't understand. Yeah, okay.
Representative Ledoux?
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gabrielle Ledoux, representative for District 15, East Anchorage, and the Elmendorf portion of J-Bear. Members of the committee, HB 126 is timely and necessary legislation. Alaska's National Guard Command has asked for a greater ability to pursue and prosecute those members who violate military rules and protocols. House Bill 126 honors that request and lays out a blueprint for administrative procedures for use by National Guard leadership in the state. Preliminarily, I would just like to again thank Representative Tuck and his staff for all of the work they have done on the issue, and I'm very grateful for their willingness to work with the Judiciary Committee staff on House Bill 126. I'd like to now turn this over to my staffer, Thomas Brown, House Judiciary Committee aide, to walk the committee through the specifics of House Bill 126.
Thank you. Before we do that, Thomas, I extend the courtesy to Representative Tuck to give, again, an opening sponsor statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the National Guard has been highlighted recently in the last year and even further back than that. But one of the things that's been very difficult for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is really having a military code of justice that they can follow, so they know exactly what needs to be done, what they can do, and how we can keep moving our National Guard forward. And so this establishes a set of procedural and substantive criminal laws. And we have a model code that we've had with the Department of Defense that it was really difficult trying to pull this all together. So this is a really good exercise. It was a learning experience, and you know, Alaska is unique in many ways, and our statutes are unique, and that's what made it very difficult in bringing everything together. So I think this is a good draft, a good working document to come up with something that all of our military that serves in the National Guard will be confident and we'll have a process put in place that protects people and ensures its integrity.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Thomas, you have the floor. Please put yourself on the record and discuss the bill for us. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Thomas Brown, staff to Representative Ledoux and House Judiciary Committee aide. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HB 126 would grant the Alaska National Guard a basic legal framework to establish a functioning system of military justice. I would also like to thank Representative Tuck and his staff for their efforts on this issue. As the committee is aware, Representative Tuck's bill, HB 121, was a very similar piece of legislation, so similar that HB 126 has rolled a significant portion of HB 121 into it. Although both bills have very similar goals, they achieve them through very different methods. Whereas HB 121 sought broad statutory revisions, this bill would grant a greater amount of administrative authority to the Guard to achieve the same ends. Upon consultation with the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and National Guard leadership, it was decided that this latter method was preferable for all parties. We do not anticipate HB 126 passing the legislature this session. This is merely the start of the process. The hope is that through working with members over the interim, the more technical problems can be discovered and the details hammered out over the intervening months. The goal, as we see it, is to have a nearly perfect bill so that we can pass the bill early next session. Now, if it pleases the committee, I'm going to walk you through a cursory section analysis of HB 126 and then hand the reins over to First Lieutenant Forrest Dunbar, Alaska Army National Guard, for a short presentation of his own. At first glance, this is a very short bill. There's only 14 sections. However, Section 4, the bulk of it, comprises 34 pages. So bear with me, please. Section 1, beginning on page 1, designates the Alaska Court of Appeals as the appellate court for service members who have exhausted their administrative appeals. Section 2 limits criminal liability for Guard members for any act done in their official capacity in the line of duty, but does not apply to charges already brought before a military court. Section 3 is a mere conforming amendment. Section 4, the aforementioned bulk of the bill, creates a new article, the Code of Military Justice. Of the new sections in this article, it firstly instructs the Adjutant General to adopt regulations for a Code of Military Justice under the terms of this chapter, which will include the organization of courts-martial, providing for non-judicial punishment, NJP, identify which offenses are subject to court-martial or NJP, identify allowable punishments for such offenses, identify the rules of trial, pre-trial, post-trial, and related procedures, organize courts of inquiry, and provide adequate protection for classified information from the general public. The other sections in the new Code of Military Justice include, starting on page 4, a statement that all non-military offenses shall be tried in civilian court. Granting of exclusive jurisdiction of courts-martial over the Code of Military Justice and specifying that the Code applies to all military offenses. It sets jurisdiction of the military code over deserters and fraudulently discharged personnel and those members who commit their offense outside of the state or happen to live outside of the state when they are charged with their offense. On page 5, it details the duties and qualifications of those who will serve as judge advocates. On 5 and 6, it defines who may apprehend members accused of a military offense and how that apprehension is to take place. On 6 and 7, it defines how a member may be arrested, under what conditions they may be arrested, who may do so, and how they may be confined. Page 7 defines how a member accused of a military offense may be delivered to a civilian authority. Pages 8 through 11 describe the composition, duties, terms of service, and jurisdictions of all courts-martial. On pages 11 and 12, it describes the duties and qualifications of trial counsel, defense counsel, assistant counsel, court reporters, and interpreters for courts-martial. On page 13, it specifies the procedures for bringing charges against a member. Also on page 13, it prevents the self-incrimination of the accused. Page 14 lays out the investigatory process. Pages 15 through 17 lay out how charges may be processed and the procedures for continuances, oaths of office for court officers. Page 19 defines the statutes of limitations for military offenses. It also prohibits double jeopardy charges and describes how pleas of the accused are to be processed. And 19 through 20, it defines how subpoenas and contempt of court charges are to be processed. Pages 20 through 23 provide for the insanity defense for the accused and also the determination for a mental competency of the accused. Pages 23 and 24 describe the procedures for voting and ruling in courts martial. Pages 24 and 25 require the recordings of all courts martial. Pages 25 and 27 describes the allowable punishments and sentences for the accused and prohibits cruel and unusual punishments. 27 and 28 describe the appeals process in the military code, including appeals by the state. Page 28 allows for a vacation of suspension under certain circumstances. Pages 28 and 29 allow for the accused to petition for a new trial and describe how restoration of privileges may be achieved. Pages 29 through 32 describe the composition and duties of the Military Appeals Commission formerly mentioned. Page 32 defines who may administer oaths for the purposes of military administration proceedings and allows for the governor to delegate authority for the Code of Military Justice. On page 33, we create a military justice account inside the general fund. We also describe the system of paying and collection of fines associated with punishments in the military code. 33 and 34 describe the pay scale of officers and witnesses of courts martial. Page 34 provides immunity for persons who acted pursuant to their duties under the military code. 34 and 36 define terms associated with the new article. We finally come to a new section, section 5 on page 36. It further defines what held under authority of state law means, and it includes persons held under the military code. Same page, section 6, describes how persons convicted under the military code are to be restrained or confined. Same page, section 7, requires the Attorney General for the State of Alaska to assist courts martial in cases of mental incompetency. Same page, section 8, is a conforming amendment dealing with the duties of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Section 9 is just the repeal section. Section 10, applicability clause. Section 11 establishes and describes the terms of office of the Military Appeals Commission. Section 12 on page 37 and 38 authorizes the Adjutant General to enact and enforce the regulations under the Code of Military Justice upon approval of the Governor. And section 13 and 14 are effective dates for the provisions of the bill. And if there are no immediate questions, I would ask to hand the proceedings over to First Lieutenant Dunbar, who has a short presentation of his own.
Yes, Representative Greenberg. Do you want questions for Mr. Brown now, or do you want to wait until Mr. Dunbar?
I got to do a little bit of housekeeping here, but let's ask the lieutenant to do it first before we get any questions. Then we can ask both Thomas and the lieutenant to answer those. Okay. But for the housekeeping is that for the new members that were not here at the opening, it is my intent to hold the bill over to the next meeting, but it is my intent to move it out at the next meeting as I have prepared an amendment, and we'll talk about that amendment later in the meeting. But I have a bill up in House Finance that I'm going to testify on, and so at this time I'm going to turn the gavel over to my Vice Chair, Representative Ledoux, and I'll return when I can. Thank you.
And I'd like to note for the record that Representative Lynn has joined us. And Representative Hughes, I think, and I'm not sure whether...
Culver.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Representative Ledoux, this is also my superior, Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole. He will be joining us in giving this presentation, also with the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs.
Good morning, committee. On behalf of Commissioner Lori Hummel, who cannot be here today, just want to make a few comments at the beginning. The Alaska National Guard traces its heritage back to the militias of the states, the colonies that predate the formation of our United States. These militias were under the command and control of the governor, and they're what enabled the creation of our United States, and that heritage goes through today. And a couple key things there. They remain under the command and control of the governor. Day in and day out, myself, I report on the civilian side as well as Lieutenant Dunbar on the military side as Alaska National Guard officer to the governor, ultimately as our commander-in-chief. And also under state and federal law, the Guard is recognized that the commander-in-chief is the governor. Now, there's some confusion because the federal government recognizes the federal interest in a ready militia and provide substantial dollars to our state dollars to organize, train, and equip the National Guard. Nevertheless, it remains a state militia. It's the state's obligation and authority to provide for the good discipline and order. In that regard, we'd like to thank two members of this committee in particular. First, Representative Tuck, for providing the persistent focus on this issue necessary to bring it forward. And second, Madam Chairman, Representative Ledoux, for embracing this issue for a bipartisan solution that's necessary for us to go forward on this issue. Next slide, please. The key points that we see from the departmental level and why we support it. It provides an enabling statute which provides us to assure that we can keep up with developments in the Uniform Code of Military Justice at the federal level as they evolve and maintain kind of synchronization of that. It also addresses the unique Alaska concerns for due process that do not exist in other states in this context. We believe it's the right mechanism at the right time to address the National Guard issues that have arisen and the need to show that we can maintain good discipline and order. Of note, we're not going to create something redundant of the civilian criminal law system in the state. We're going to supplement that to do what we need to do. And this, like any law in the books, the object is deterrence. It isn't to create a whole new class of doing proceedings, but rather to put the tool out there so you don't have to deal with certain types of misconduct. Looking at other states, we envision using it minimally. Washington and Oregon actually use it once a year, once people realize that there's a tool out there to hold them to standard. Oh, and one more to me. Looking at this graphically, we all like three stool analogies in Alaska. And for us, the missing stool right now in maintaining good order and discipline is that we do not have a mechanism for an Alaska Code of Military Justice, a court-martial or non-judicial commission. We have administrative law that we can use to just out and out separate somebody from the Guard. We have Alaska criminal law, but we don't have that means for the individual whose transgression. We can still reform the individual, but we need another tool in the toolkit or another means to balance out things to provide good order and discipline.
Thank you. So I'd just like to note for the committee that in addition to being the Deputy Commissioner, Bob Dole is also a retired colonel and has quite a bit of knowledge on these issues. So he'll be helping answer questions as well. Hopefully online we should have soon.
And Forrest, before you go any further, could you just identify yourself for the record?
I apologize. My name is Forrest Dunbar. I am a First Lieutenant with the Alaska Army National Guard. And hopefully online we should also have Captain Jennifer King during the question and answer period. She should be available. She has experience on active duty conducting courts martial. So again, to start at the beginning here, but hopefully quickly, we do have a territorial era military code in the state of Alaska, Title 26. However, it does not provide for a code of military justice. It says that the Guard may create one, but it doesn't lay out the necessary procedures, and it doesn't require the Guard to do so, which HB 126 does. There is also a federal Uniform Code of Military Justice. The UCMJ, as I'll refer to it, has basically every criminal offense you can imagine. It has very similar to a state's code of criminal law, in addition to a number of military offenses. And as Deputy Commissioner Dole mentioned earlier, in our Alaska Code of Military Justice, as we plan it, we will not mirror the UCMJ in this way. We will not have civilian criminal offenses. We will limit ourselves to military offenses. Now, of course, there is still the Alaska State Criminal Code that applies to our soldiers. And the next couple of slides will describe why we have these sort of overlapping or multiple kinds of levels of law that apply to our soldiers. So I've spoken with many people on this committee outside of this process and tried to describe the different statuses that our soldiers and airmen can go through. But just very quickly, the three primary statuses a soldier or airman, sorry, service member can find themselves in. I'm sorry, I keep saying soldier because I'm in the Army component, but we have
Guardsman works fine.
Guardsman as well. So we have Title 32, which is the most common type of status that a guardsman can be in. So when you think of a typical Alaska National Guard guardsman going to their duty weekend, they are in Title 32 status. In that status, they are commanded by the governor, our commander-in-chief, but they are resourced, paid for, by the federal government. We have a very large program called Active Guard Reserve, or AGR, which are full-time guardsmen. And those are also Title 32. Now, the second status is Title 10, which is when we as guardsmen are, or guardswomen, are fully federalized and sent to somewhere like Iraq or Afghanistan. There are other circumstances as well, but in that status you are Title 10. Now, the important thing to remember about Title 10 is in Title 10 you are subject to the federal UCMJ, the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice. Their set of what is essentially criminal law applies to you, but only in Title 10. It does not apply in Title 32 or in the third status, which is state active duty, where you are commanded by the state and also paid by the state. This is typically in disaster response, things like that. I'm from Cordova, so I use the recent example of the National Guard helping dig us out from a gigantic mountain of snow. So just visually, again, the three primary statuses are state active duty, Title 32, and Title 10. Now, Title 10 applies, the federal UCMJ applies to active duty U.S. military and to fully federalized National Guard's soldiers and airmen. The Alaska Criminal Code, of course, applies to guardsmen at all times when you are in the state. When you are, regardless of what your status is, you are under the state criminal laws. However, there is no, at present, there is no military code of justice that applies to Title 32 or state active duty guardsmen. And this is what we are seeking to address with this bill. And again, the goal is good order and discipline of the forces. As I believe Deputy Commissioner Dole alluded to and Representative Tuck described, there have been some recent issues in the Alaska National Guard with good order and discipline. And one of the reasons for that, and there's going to be a multifaceted approach to tackling those issues, but one of the reasons for that is because this left leg of this stool, which is the what we call the ACMJ, has not been available both for courts-martial and for non-judicial punishment. Non-judicial punishment is a much more frequently used tool by commanders. It doesn't result in a trial, it doesn't result in as large punishments, but it's a way to swiftly and certainly discipline soldiers. So again, the five typical tools that our commanders and our administrators use are, first of all, administrative actions, things like letters of reprimand, also administrative separation, which is when we dismiss you from the Guard. And at the at present, we can give an honorable, a general under honorable conditions, or an other than honorable discharge, characterization of service. We cannot, at present, give bad conduct discharges or dishonorable discharges. So in the history of the Alaska Army National Alaska National Guard, since statehood, we have not given a dishonorable discharge. It is a tool that has not been available to us, but will be available to us once we have this code of military justice. Now, you cannot give that a dishonorable discharge or even a bad conduct discharge with nonjudicial punishment or with a summary courts martial. For a dishonorable, I believe you require a general courts martial. So, our current plan of action, first of all, we support this legislation. And again, it's a result of a lot of hard work from Representative Ledoux and her staff and Representative Tuck and his staff. Specifically, I'd like to acknowledge Tom and Kendra, who have put in many hours into this bill, and I've had the pleasure to work with them. And we support the approach of this bill, which will allow us, in us being the National Guard, to develop a set of regulations that lay out specific offenses and penalties, as well as procedures and a regulation for nonjudicial punishment. Now, we plan to do that over the summer. So our hope is that this bill will move through committee here. But then over the interim, we'll have the opportunity to work with your offices and with people on the Judiciary Committee to hammer out the details of the statutory language. Also bring in commanders and get their input, because this code of military justice won't really work unless we have buy-in from our commanders, and they know how to use it, and they are in agreement that we have the appropriate offenses and penalties. So we hope to bring in our commanders, develop that regulation with them, and then before next session, we hope to have regulations that we can bring to representatives and say, this is what we plan to adopt if you were to pass this statute. Again, we'll have several regulations, and we'll also be working on the statutory language over the course of the summer, so and into the fall. With that, I'd just like to open it up for any questions you might have. Again, I believe we have online Captain Jennifer King. Is there some way to test that, ma'am?
She's listed as online.
Okay, great.
And we also have from the Alaska court system, Nancy Mead, to answer any questions with respect to the interplay between this bill and the Alaska courts. So are there any questions for either Lieutenant Dunbar or Commissioner Dahl? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering, in view of the language on page 2, lines 14 through 16, why that provision was not included in the applicability clause here, which is back on section 10 on page 37. It seems to me that you should take a look at amending section 10 to include the gravamen of the underlying section in page 2, lines 14 through 16. I don't need an answer. They can look at that.
All right. Well, we will make note of that, and you will certainly be included, Representative Grunberg. We'd like to have your input while we work on this bill over the interim.
Thank you. I really like that. And may I continue, please?
Yes. Go right ahead.
The other thing that I caught is on page 34, lines 3 through 5, and I'm sorry, the first time I've looked at this was just while you guys were testifying.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean there. Let me sort of ask a leading question, if I may.
And, Mr. Brown, would you like to join us up here also so that if anybody has any questions for either of the three, they can be.
This goes to the two lawyers. With no disrespect to you. It sounds to me like what you're saying here is that if we adopt whatever it is here, let's say thou shalt not commit murder or whatever it is, that would be interpreted as the equivalent provision in the UCMJ. Is that correct? And then I want to follow up.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, I believe that is correct. That is essentially correct. There is a well-developed, a large body of jurisprudence, as you can imagine, that's developed around the UCMJ, and this provision makes that persuasive, although not controlling, precedent.
Oh, because normally, as I understand...
The chair.
Yes, if I can dialogue for a minute, please. As I understand it, at least from early cases of the last jurisprudence, if you adopt a law from another state, then the interpretation put on that law from the other states, and I think its highest court, it may include like a court of appeals or something, is binding. And if the interpretation is after you adopt that law in Alaska, it is simply persuasive. And I believe that, and we can ask our alleged legal if necessary on this.
And we also have Ms. Mead from the courts who might like to address that.
I'm not sure she would, but she's not here to talk about how the court would interpret it, but procedure, I think. But anyway, and if you adopt a uniform act, it's interpreted the same way. So like if we adopted the UCC, Uniform Commercial Code, that other state courts, highest courts, that have previously ruled would be binding on us. I don't know what happens if there are two that go different ways, but if they're uniform. And that's a major advantage of adopting uniform acts, the Power of Attorney Act and those things.
So I would at some point, when you're finished with this dialogue with Lieutenant Dunbar and Commissioner Dole, I would actually like to ask Ms. Mead from the court system whether that is her understanding.
Oh, sure. But this here sounds like it's different, like it's simply persuasive. And I don't know if that's the case. I'd like you folks to please look into that, because I don't really know the court system of the military. I know there's the Court of Military Appeals, and occasionally you can get up on constitutional issue to the U.S. Supreme Court. But I don't know the levels of courts, and I think it's very important to the chair that we really understand how this is going to work, this one section.
And Representative Bloomberg, you're talking about Section 2605-560?
Yes, ma'am.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we will certainly examine the impact there. The intent, though, was given that there really isn't a consistent body of law at the state level in looking at these military code provisions, because there is still variance and not there on how the uniform code has been adopted, to look to the Article 1 and Article 3 courts as they have interpreted the Federal Code of Military Justice and as they have developed that body of law, and that body of law frankly continues to evolve. I'm scratching my head trying to think back to some of the case law from our Supreme Court in the 70s and all, and looking at that body of law when we brought in adopting various statutes. And I think at any time it remains persuasive to this jurisdiction, was my best recollection of those that case law from back then, rather than controlling in Alaska.
Through the chair, we can all look at that.
Yes.
The issue may be, I was going to say clouded, I'm not sure, But if a number of crimes, and I'm going to call them crimes, will not be adopted by the legislature, but be adopted administratively, how that will play into this, because in the past, all the precedent I'm aware of is done by judges, not by an administrative agency. And if you're going to be enacting the statute through a regulation, the ruling of the statute will be absolutely key. And anyway, this is what I think is going to be something that I'm going to have to look at.
And that's why we have Summers. Ms. Mead, would you care to, or even if you don't care, would you? So, Ms. Mead, it's always been my understanding that if we adopt a law of another state, that law, the interpretation of that law by the highest court of the other state would be persuasive on our courts, but would not be binding upon our courts. Who's right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, and I'm sure Ledge Legal will give you the definitive answer, but my understanding is that by adopting codes from other jurisdictions, for example, what Alaska did largely at the onset of statehood by taking some of the statutes from Oregon and choosing some other provisions from other states, but largely Oregon, that the Oregon court's interpretation of those provisions are highly persuasive on the Alaska court, but I don't think that they sacrificed their right to interpret them in some other way. So those are, in my opinion, I've always thought that those were persuasive, and the same as when we adopt uniform laws, the advantage to the state is interpretations of provisions in those by other states who have similar uniform laws are persuasive on our courts, but not binding.
Representative Bloomberg.
It's been a long time since, and I seem to think there was a case called Beckley versus the state on that, but I don't remember. And of course, if it's binding, that means you can always overrule it or modify it or whatever. Anyway, we'll look at that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Would you like to join us again? Representative Hughes.
I'm not going to, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to get into the weeds quite yet, but a little bit of foundational. If you go back a couple slides, the number 4 and 5 in red are the ones the bill covers. And just because some of us haven't served in the military, we're not quite so familiar, could you give examples of when we might move from 4 to 5? And for number 4, it doesn't have to go, what kind of procedure would it have to follow in order for a non-judicial punishment to be issued? Is it just a decision of an officer? Just give us an example, please.
So some of the procedures will be set out in regulation. That was one of the things that we've been asked to do by HB 126. In general, as I said, the broadest level, when you go from 4 to 5, the charge is more serious. That's the most simple way to put it. There are certain punishments that can be brought through NJP, and we allow certain officers at certain levels to bring different kinds of punishments. But actually, Commissioner, do you have an example of maybe an offense you can recall from your time in active duty?
Okay, basically a non-judicial punishment, the person accused of the offense always has the right to request judicial punishment instead, i.e. a special court-martial, which would have a more severe penalty. But basically, the non-judicial punishment is for the sleeping on duty, the failure to show up for duty, the relatively minor things in the scheme of things, versus you would look at the court-martial or the more serious offense for an open for openly for a much more egregious thing, such as urging a group not to follow a direct order, saying, no, don't go to Cordova to dig out the snow. We don't need to go help the Cordova folks. That sort of, but it's a much more serious offense versus the minor things where you look at the non-judicial punishment, the swearing at another person or something else that's contrary to good discipline and order. And as they get more serious is when you graduate to the court martial as a general rule.
And follow up? And then so for the non-judicial punishment, it would just be, as far as how it would proceed, it would be a decision by an officer, and he or she could just issue that, or does it have to go through some process and be approved? Or?
Well, it basically is just one officer deciding it. There's still a process they have to follow to give the individual a right to be heard, to have somebody speak for the individual who's been accused of something to present evidence on why that shouldn't be done that way and why it's unfair. It also, that one officer's decision can be challenged within the chain of command to make sure it's not excessive and that there's a reasonable basis for it. So it isn't that one officer. There are checks and balances, and he's also limited on the type of information he can consider.
And I have a new question. Is that okay?
Go right ahead.
Yes, and I'm intrigued by the process of working on this over the interim, and I'm wondering, it's rather unusual to have the proposed regs drawn up before the bill is passed, before you have a statute in place, so that'll be different. I was wondering, have other states gone about it that way, or is that just something that you thought might make sense here, and as well as whether that's been done elsewhere, if this is a rather innovative way for that we're doing it. The chain of command that's going to be involved over the interim, will that go all the way down to the airman and the soldier, or it will just be officers?
Representative Hughes, through the chair. So I can't speak to whether other states have done this over the interim. Part of it, I think, is because we have a part-time legislature. It makes it a little bit unique. I will say that other states, and I think Oregon is an example, have, instead of specifying every offense in the statute, have adopted regulations the way that we are doing for their substantive offenses. So there might be some element of innovation in the way that we are going to be gathering feedback, but in general, this is not, we don't consider this to be a particularly innovative bill, if that makes sense, or a particularly innovative code. We are looking to draw on the experience of both the federal UCMJ, but also, just importantly, other states, what they have done, and the model code, which is handed down by National Guard Bureau, which we can choose to follow or not follow. That was, I believe, where Representative Tuck and his office got most of the substantive provisions that were in HB 121, and we think that's a logical starting point for at least discussions with our commanders when we're talking about different offenses. Now, there are some rather archaic offenses in those model codes, like dueling, for example, which we probably will not bring. We might. There might be some reason to have dueling in our regulations, but it's something we're going to talk to with our commanders. And I do believe that there will be a place, and perhaps the Deputy Commissioner can speak to this, but we hope to have a broad cross-section of our soldiers and airmen have the opportunity to speak with us and with command and give feedback and input into these proposed regulations.
Through the chair. Representative Hughes, if you look at number four, the Commander's Action Group, that will go down to that airman level with extensive input from the senior enlisted advisors, the command sergeant majors, and the chief master sergeants from each of the branches to make sure this truly encompasses and makes sense throughout the ranks and isn't something that only makes sense at the top tier or top echelon. So that is being seriously taken into account. Also, in terms of drafting the regulations while the legislation is still in draft form, we felt because of the importance of this issue, it was necessary to go forward, and also in terms of to enable legislative oversight to see show how what you are doing here will be utilized. We greatly appreciate the persistent focus Representative Chuck has brought to it and Representative Ledoux's ongoing bipartisan engagement. But in order to move the process along and also to simplify the oversight to say this is how we envision carrying out the legislation you're giving us, we felt it best to proceed now rather than wait.
Go ahead.
Yes, and I think you may have covered this. I'm sorry if I missed it, but did we start kind of as a straw man here? Did we take the UM?
UMJ?
Yeah, that. Did we take that and pull out the criminal part and start with the military part? Is that kind of what we're starting as the basis to, because as I understand it, when an active duty person goes overseas, you know, they may do something that's a military, there may be a military charge as opposed to a criminal charge, so they have to have both, but we're just doing the military piece. So just wondering if you started with that and stripped out the criminal, and that's...
Yes, so through the chair, Representative Hughes, that is one way to conceive it, that this is going to be essentially the UCMJ stripped of non-military offenses, left with just military offenses. It is not currently laid out in the statute. That will be adopted by regulation. There may be certain offenses that we don't take forward. There may be other offenses we deem that are necessary. This is ultimately going to be an Alaskan document, the statute and the regulation. One example of a change that we've already made, at the federal level and in some other states, you can be convicted by two-thirds of a panel, of a court-martial. Based on analysis done by Legislative Legal and our own analysis, we determined that Alaska's Constitution has stronger protections for people who could be prosecuted, and they have the right to a unanimous verdict by the panel. And so we've already actually adapted this statute. So while it will have a lot of similarities to the military offenses in the UCMJ and to other state codes, there will be a distinctly Alaskan flavor to the ACMJ.
One more. Last one. This is a quick one. Speaking of other states, are we one of the few or only states that has not yet gone through this process and adopted a code?
I actually think that Captain King may have done a little bit more thorough survey. I'm looking at the ceiling because I'm hoping she's online. I know that we are in the minority. I can't say what the exact number of other states that have this code are, or this kind of code are.
Thank you.
Why don't we ask Ms. King? Ms. King, are you on the line?
Through the chair to Representative Hughes. For the record, my name is Captain Jennifer King. I am a military attorney with the Alaska Army National Guard. I don't have an exact number of states that are operating without their own state UCMJ. I can say that we are not the last one. I know currently Alabama is working through theirs. They have just put theirs into place in 2015. Kentucky is doing the same. They're revising the one that they did 2 years ago. So it's something that other states are looking at.
Thank you.
Thank you. I got one question and then Representative Tuck. So do any of the states that have adopted new codes or codes include criminal laws? I mean, the code that we're thinking about adopting is the military code, the federal military, basically the federal military code, stripped of its criminal aspect. Do any of the states have state codes which are not stripped of their criminal aspects?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I could try to find that out for you. I don't know if Deputy Commissioner Dole has that answer.
Madam Chair, I would have to frankly go back to probably the legislative research on that. I believe some have criminal codes on the book. I believe they are rarely, if ever, exercised. The challenge we have in Alaska with the size of our military of 4,000 is the infrastructure it takes to provide for procedural and substantive due process. For instance, putting together a panel or a jury in civilian speak of members in rank above the rank of the individual with that small of a pool to start is daunting for a felony case, to say the least, as we all know from our experiences in rural Alaska trying to form a jury.
Thank you. Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going to that slide, it talks about, just carrying on what Representative Hughes was asking about with the non-judicial punishment versus court-martial under the ACMJ. I know that one of the problems that we've had with our old
Military Code of Justice here in the state of Alaska, it hasn't been revised since, I think, 1955, is there was no checks and balances, and not all members knew what to expect on discipline. And it was some favoritism that took place with one group versus another group, or one individual or another individual, and leadership was able to pick and choose what they wanted to do. One of my concerns is, just a little bit, is that we have an opportunity here to set some standards that can go from one commander to the next commander, all the way down from one generation to the next generation, and have consistency of the culture that we have. When we talk about regulations versus statutes, I don't know if when we look at court martials, some of that we may want to put in statutes. So I hope you guys are open to that idea, just to make sure that unilaterally things doesn't change with a different commander going into place, because that's one of the problems that we've had in the past is things changing. Unfortunately, overnight. I know regulations are a little bit slower than that, but when we look at reasons, you know, whether it's conspiracy, desertion, anything that's unlawful in the military code that requires a court martial, want to put in statute. So I'd like the process that we're doing right now, giving you guys an opportunity to do all your research, looking what's appropriate, what isn't appropriate, but then down the road, hopefully looking to see what should actually be statutory.
So Representative Tuck, through the chair, it is true, as you allude to, that regardless what we put in the law, and I would argue this is statute or regulation, if we do not have good commanders that are willing to enforce it and to use it appropriately, we are frustrated in our aims. However, there are quite a few provisions within the current bill, HB 126, that define how a court-martial will take place, for example. And one of the key differences between this bill and the existing military code is that it says the National Guard shall create these regulations, not we may. And we hope that that will bind future commanders and adjutants general to create these substantive offenses. But you are correct that by putting this in regulation rather than statute, we are putting some trust in this command that we will develop appropriate regulations and that we will enforce them.
If I may follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think one of the best ways to bind future commanders is statutes versus regulations. So just keep open to things that we may want to put in concrete just a little bit stronger, that especially for procedures and everything. So thank you.
Representative Tuck, we look forward to working with y'all over the summer in terms of the process. The challenge with binding statutes is the need to keep the statutes current as the law evolves, and particularly in this area, given evolution under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, just in the digital age and the new challenges presented by maintaining good order and discipline with all the digital ways military members can get in trouble. It's an area that is difficult to foresee and forecast, and keep coming back to the legislature as amendments need to be happened. If you think of the texting law a couple of years ago and how there was one version, they need to come back again after a court interpretation. That's just a microcosm compared to just the things happening underway right now looking at military justice.
So Commissioner Dole, The federal scheme, is that in statute or is that in regulations?
That is in Title 10 of the United States Code. If you think of the three circles we showed earlier, it is in the rightmost one.
Then how does the military deal with Congress in order, which is not exactly operating at a quick pace, to change things?
There is the challenges of getting congressional attention to things and keeping up with a code that is relevant and timely and effective for the force as Congress balances everything else they need to balance.
Thank you. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just the follow-up on that, and that's true. I mean, that's what we, that's the reason why we have legislatures, is that things change. Laws change. We have to make amendments to laws. You know, we have Sherman Antitrust Act, which was later came up with the Clayton Act, an amendment to that act. So things do change. But one of the concerns is that change doesn't go in the wrong direction, goes in the wrong direction unnoticed. So I'll just ask them that we keep open to looking at this. You know, we may not need anything in statute, but just keep open to the idea of things that may want to keep from one generation to the next generation. And if not, then things that we may foresee changing, but we think should have a good public process in making those changes. So thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are things in Alaska law that are not found in federal, particularly federal military law. Do you plan, let's say there's a cyber crime or something that's, you know, I don't have anything particular in mind, that's has no equivalent under the UCMJ. If somebody who was Title 32, you know, temporarily on active duty or weekend or whatever, violated that, would the intent be that would be prosecuted through the Alaska civil authorities?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, if it were cognizable under Alaska civilian criminal law, yes. The statement of policy here, which has been maintained from the old code, is that the civilian authorities have the first bite at the apple, and that's why we are not including all of you know, typical civilian crimes in our code. We don't plan to. So if there was a cyber crime, there was a crime under the laws of the state of Alaska, we would hope and expect that it would be prosecuted by the civilian authorities.
May I please continue?
Go ahead.
Did you want to say something?
Go ahead, Representative Greenberg.
The next question. You have indicated this is being drafted with an eye towards the Alaska Constitution. I assume that the thought, although I'm not asking that this dialogue be of constitutional dimensions, that the Alaska Constitution would be applicable to this new Alaska code. Well, actually, I'm going to ask that. Is it your intent and belief as you're drafting this that this state law be governed by the Alaska Constitution as well as the federal Constitution?
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, absolutely. This is a state law. It is why there's double jeopardy. If a civilian authority prosecutes one of our guards member and takes it to the point where jeopardy attaches, we cannot come back and court-martial them because it's the same sovereign. This is all Alaska law and absolutely is governed by the Constitution of the state of Alaska.
May I continue, please?
Go ahead.
Would that then include the provisions of Title 12 on sentencing, aggravators and mitigators, and the right to a jury on that sort of thing? You, the chair.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, clearly if it's a actionable, cognizable under Title 11, the Alaska Criminal Code, then it would be tried in civilian courts. Title 12 would apply. One of the reasons we talk about needing time to write the regulations is to look at the applicability of how those aggravating and mitigating factors of Title 12 would work in an administrative context here.
And then I won't go there today. I'll leave that to further research and policy decisions. Okay.
Through the chair.
I'm trying to think of my question.
Address it through the chair when you think of it.
The question then would be on the non-equivalent kinds of crimes that are
taken from the UCMJ or whatever, would it be your understanding that the Alaska Constitution would apply to them as well? I assume the answer is yes. Yeah, you have to speak.
I'm sorry. Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, yes. So our belief is that the Alaska Constitution would continue to apply.
Now through the chair. For these mitigators and aggravators, I guess I wouldn't expect an answer from you on that today, but I would hope that regardless of the genesis of whatever it is, that's one thing that I'm going to be looking forward to seeing, as well as whether there are any other provisions in Title 11, 12, or elsewhere that would be applicable. Plus, there are crimes that are not in Title 11 but are under state law, Title 28, some cruelty to animals, various kinds of things, Title 3 stuff, although that isn't. I assume you'll be looking at all of that.
Through the chair, yes, Representative Greenberg, we'll be looking to those kind of aggregators and mitigators.
Thank you.
So I'm a little bit confused here. Why would you be looking at aggravators and mitigators if it's not, it sounds to me like what you're doing in identifying these military offenses is that it's almost like employment law. It's civil stuff. It's not criminal stuff. Aggravators and mitigators apply to, it's my understanding, to the criminal law, where somebody has committed a crime under state law. These things, and if they've committed a crime under state law, it's going to go to the state authorities. These things would not be crimes under the state law.
So, Madam Chair, it is true that if a civilian criminal law applies, then we would hope that would be prosecuted in civilian courts. However, I do think that for the substantive provisions of the ACMJ, as we create it, would be more similar to criminal law than to employment law. Because if you look at, for example, a general court martial, you can receive a prison sentence of up to 10 years. You can, for it tracks, for a special court martial, you can get up to a year, which is equivalent to a misdemeanor. In a lot of ways, it is more similar to our criminal law. But the offenses, the military offenses, are unique. And I suppose in that sense, perhaps it is like we are a large employer and we have our own standards that do not apply to the rest of the citizens of Alaska. Things like dereliction of duty, conduct unbecoming an officer, those kind of substantive offenses. But given the nature of the penalties, where you can be confined, imprisoned for up to 10 years, we do believe it is more similar to criminal law, and thus will have to conform to the protections that a criminal defendant would receive.
Thank you. The interplay here really is pretty fascinating.
Yeah. On that point.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we look at just one question. If we look at what happened in the last several days, the guy who went over to the Taliban, he is facing major criminal penalties. This is really serious crimes, and like desertion, you can be executed. I don't know if that's just in wartime, so there are things that have no equivalent in civilian law, but are major criminal provisions and have to be under the military code. Through the chair, any comment?
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, we agree. This is a fascinating area because we're taking a military context of what constitutes criminal law and applying it under the regimen of the Alaska Constitution. But long and short of it, that's why we're going to be diligently working hard on it this summer to try to deconflict and sort out those things. Ultimately, what we do has to comport with the Alaska Constitution as well as the federal Constitution, a requirement the feds don't have because we're in Alaska. Governmental entity, and we will do that. But I agree that there are some significant issues and challenges there to kind of find the way for this entity, as we go forward, and in that unique area where we overlap and where the Alaska National Guard regularly rests jurisdictionally.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just thinking about the potential consequences, you know, general court-martial could be 10 years, desertion could be execution, you know, which I don't know. Probably not, huh? Okay. That's what I heard. And so, but I don't know how the state does it now, regulations versus statutes on criminal code, on, you know, what we put in regulations, what we put in statutes. I was wondering if it's all possible we can bring Nancy back up just to say where there's a line or how that works.
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead with the Alaska court system. I think what, through the chair, Representative Tuck, what you were getting at is where currently in Alaska law, criminal penalties and criminal rights and duties are set forth. And that is in statute, as the gentleman before me testified. Title 11 is basically substantive criminal law, and Title 12 is procedures to implement all the criminal laws in Title 11. And again, there are criminal prohibitions in other sections of Alaska statutes as well. Currently, there aren't in Alaska regulation any criminal provisions. Agencies don't, for example, the Department of Public Safety can't put criminal provisions in their regulations, nor can the Department of Law, the District Attorney's Office, anything like that. Those have to be in Alaska statutes. Regulations can provide for civil penalties. If you think of maybe a parking ticket, you can have to pay a fine. And those can be regulations. They can be municipal. But the current status of the law is that the where criminal offenses are set forth is in statute, but not through regulation.
If I can follow.
One question before we. What about the ABC board? I thought that they were promulgating or could promulgate regulations which would be criminal. Did I misunderstand that?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think that would be Representative Ledoux. I'm sorry. I would have to say that I don't know the full answer to that question. My understanding was that the board could do civil penalties but did not do crimes, but I could be incorrect on that. And that's why they have violations set forth in their regs, but not people can't be sent to jail, for example. But I could be incorrect.
And I guess I was just brought to my attention, maybe Fish and Game can be able to do that too. But through the chair, I guess that's the question that I have is what other departments can create their own offenses and punishments when looking at policing their jurisdictions? So I don't know if Fish and Game can do that. I don't know if the alcohol board can do that. I don't know if the marijuana board may be able to do that. But yeah, if you don't mind looking into that.
Okay, through the chair, Representative Tuck. I can find out. I'm afraid I've exhausted my knowledge on the issue. But, of course, usually criminal laws are in statute.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can I just add one more clarification? Okay. The court's interest in this bill is because, of course, at the end of the bill, it says that appeals after a person has exhausted all their appeals within the court-martial and within the military can go to the Alaska Court of Appeals. And so the court is interested in the interplay between what's covered under typical civilian law and what would be covered under what will be in the Code of Military Justice, whether it's statutes or regulations. And my understanding from talking to staff and some people who are interested is that if something is a crime, it is absolutely not going to be in the Code of Military Justice. And as Mr. Dunbar testified, so the code would just be covering things like desertion or conduct on becoming an officer, so that if somebody does something untoward that seems somewhat criminal and the state district attorney's office, for example, declines to prosecute, perhaps there isn't enough evidence to establish all the elements of the crime under the typical criminal law, then this would fill in that gap, and under the code they could be court-martialed for conduct unbecoming, although it doesn't rise to the level of a criminal offense. And that's my understanding. of how the two would be interplaying. This fills the gap, it is what I think, and I'm sure that the gentleman will correct me if I misunderstand, but that's my current understanding.
And I think the next time we hear this bill, that it would be helpful to have a representative of the Department of Law here who might be able to.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, Ms. Mead.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Greenberg.
And maybe the public defender, too.
Madam Chair,
Go for it.
I'd also like to respond to what Representative Tuck said. I think he has characterized things well. I also believe that Nancy Mead also characterized things well, that this would fill some gaps. And so, for example, there might be a case where one of our service members is misbehaving in a way that is very serious, but for some reason it is not a criminal offense under the civilian criminal code. In those cases, if the district attorney chooses not to prosecute, we could court-martial that individual. Now, you are correct, I believe. I believe that we will be given unique power relative to other departments to create and enforce what is essentially a criminal code. However, we will not be enforcing it against non-guard members, of course. It will only be people who voluntarily join the guard and who swear an oath to uphold our Constitution and to follow the orders and the chain of command. Also, I'd like to point out that when service members come into the Guard, one of the first things that will happen, and this happens on active duty and in other Guards, they will be briefed. One of the first things that happens is they will be briefed on the criminal code and say, here are the new laws, essentially, that apply to you because you have chosen to join our ranks. You have chosen to be held to a higher standard. And we want to be absolutely clear so that we are not punishing people in an arbitrary fashion.
So would that be presented to an enlistee prior to their enlisting or after? And here's where I'm coming from. You can waive a right to jury trial. I mean, if you knowingly waive your right to jury trial in our current criminal law system, you get tried by a judge. So you can waive certain constitutional provisions. But I would think that you might have a stronger argument that people could waive some of their constitutional rights if they were apprised that they would be waiving those rights before they entered the employment.
Madam Chairman, to answer your question, first, this is an important separation of powers question that may be very well be an issue of first impression in the state of Alaska. If we look at federal law, though, and for instance, the regulation writing authority for criminal misconduct that is delegated to, like, Department of Interior and our national parks, there is, in a very similar constitution, the federal constitution to ours, there is a basis for this delegation to the executive branch. In that particular case, I'm thinking as a commander of the oath of office, or the oath every enlistee takes, where they raise their right hand and promise to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the state of Alaska and the laws therein. In that regard, at this time, we do not provide an explanation of what those are on the federal side, nor do we on the state side. You certainly bring up a good point, though, that we'll revisit with our recruiters to make sure we provide notice of what you're signing up for when you are taking that enlistment. And that's one of the things with that Commander's Action Group this summer and why we need the input from the lowest enlisted all the way up to the most senior officers, that we can capture those needs for notice, which is a key due process provision.
Thank you. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when we look at the Alaska Military Code of Justice, with pulling everything together, and you mentioned those that voluntarily enlist into the National Guard. What about civilian workers that work for the Guard? Or are there civilian workers that work for the Guard? And where do you see a line between those, if there is a line?
Through the Chair, Representative Tuck, as the bill is currently written, it only envisions actions against guardsmen, not against the civilians that work in the National Guard, such as the state employees, like or with the National Guard, like myself, but only strictly guardsmen is who it would apply to. Now, on the federal side, there are means in deployed locations to extend it to civilians working with the National Guard. At this point, as the bill is drafted, they would not come under the jurisdiction of the Alaska Code of Military Justice. That may very well be something working, you know, as we work with you all this summer, though. We can figure out if that is truly the best way forward.
How do the feds deal with it? I mean, there are many people, many civilian employees of the Army and the Air Force. How does the Federal Uniform Code of Military Justice deal with those folks?
Madam Chairman, normally it doesn't. One of those individuals does something of a criminal nature, they go to a federal district court. If they do something of employment nature, it's resolved through the rules under the Office of Personnel Management for labor law constructs. There is a narrow set of provisions, though, for both government civilians and contractors in deployed locations, i.e. Afghanistan or Iraq, where it could be addressed by a military panel. However, even there, it seems like we end up back in federal district court.
Thank you. Representative Hughes.
Thank you. I'm just trying to wrap my brain around this, the intersection with the civil courts and the courts martial, and wondering if someone, the Court of Appeals, that they could move up to that, but it's been something under the ACMJ that was for a military offense. I'm just wondering how they're going to be able to handle that, because the laws under which they're operating don't cover that. So how do you envision that even working?
Representative Hughes, through the chair. So first of all, I think it's important to, again, stress that this is a very low-frequency event. There will be relatively few cases that will make it to that level. There will probably be relatively few, perhaps even less than one a year, courts-martial. So the initial appeal is not to the Alaska Court of Appeals, but to the Military Appeals Commission. If it makes it through from there to the Alaska Court of Appeals, it will be cases of first impression, and it probably will be challenging initially for the Alaska courts. But this is something that civilian courts in other states have been able to do, and somewhere where we will develop jurisprudence and build a body of law. And hopefully most of the technical legal issues will be worked out prior to rising to that level. Most of the issues that require very specialized knowledge in military law will be worked out at the court-martial level and the Military Appeals Commission. But I think you hit a good point. This is going to be a new area of law, and it's going to be a challenge, but I think it's something that the Alaska courts are very much up to, just as courts in other civilian courts in other jurisdictions have proven to be.
Go ahead.
And this, I have two other questions, and they're short. I hope they're brief. And one of them is rewinding back to the slide where we had the five tools, and number four being the non-judicial punishment. And you mentioned somebody sleeping on the job, and I'm thinking, surely you have a way now to deal with that through some kind of administrative action, don't you? Because when we're talking about suspending or rank reduction, we're talking something more serious than that. So you do have administrative things now that you're able to do for minor offenses, like sleeping on the job, I hope.
Through the chair, when you see the letters of reprimand, the letters of counseling, you have those there, but they lack the teeth. And they're great for the first time, the second time, but you get the third or the fourth or the fifth, and they say, keep giving me the letters of reprimand or counseling. I'm still going to get paid. I'm still going to get my time off. I'm still going to get all my benefits. There's no teeth behind those in terms of what you can do with them as they accumulate. And as they get more serious is when you graduate from the, if you will, the non-punitive administrative measures, which are strictly trying to educate and guide towards a corrective answer, to something with a little more of push behind it. And that's where the suspension or the fines or reduction in rank comes in. But for that very minor level, yeah, that's where the letter of counseling or letter of reprimand works great for the individual who's motivated and wants to excel. But when you have the individual where that isn't enough to incentivize them, that's where you need that next step of the non-judicial punishment.
Okay, thank you. Follow up, that makes sense because I've got the letter, I'm going to get my pay, I'm going to get my benefits, and I'm going to keep taking my naps. That sounds like what can happen. And my last question is regarding the military justice account that is in the bill. And I'm wondering if you've done any preliminary work to see what that might entail as far as what kind of cost that might be to the state. I know it's early and as far as developing that, but because we are in the fiscal situation we are and we need to be planning ahead, I'm just wondering what kind of dollars we're talking about and also wondering whether there's any Department of Defense or anything, by doing this and creating that fund, if there might be federal dollars available at all for this.
So, Representative Hughes, through the chair, I believe that most of that is reflected in our fiscal note, where we estimate the first year, I think it was $107,000 for the first year. We think those costs will come down after we have developed our regulations and trained our initial military judges. But it is true that it costs often tens of thousands of dollars to conduct a proper court-martial with the proper due process. I'll let the Deputy Commissioner, he handles more of the finance stuff.
Through the chair, what he said would be the short answer. We have a fiscal note there, which we think is a worst-case scenario in that most states use this once in less a year. It is true that when you do one of these, it is very pricey, very fast. We will examine what is available for federal funds to go forward, and that it does enable us to do that organized training equipment. They provide substantial assistance now to our providing a ready militia. We'll see what dollars are out there. We haven't spotted any yet, though, in terms of the type, in all candor. Representative Hughes.
Thank you.
What are the unique elements of the Alaska Constitution versus the federal Constitution? If you could explain to the committee why this makes it more complicated in dealing with the Alaska Constitution than, for example, the Uniform Military Code of Justice on the federal level has to deal with the U.S. Constitution. So if you could tell the committee some of those unique things with respect to the Alaska Constitution.
Madam Chairman, some of these I think will be discovered and expounded during the interim, and we hope to work with all of your offices in developing this. But one example, which I mentioned earlier, which we've already taken account of, is that right to a unanimous jury verdict. And there are several places in the Alaska Constitution where individuals, and ultimately, despite the higher standard we believe guardsmen are held to, we are all still citizens of the state of Alaska, and the Alaska Constitution provides unique protections for individuals and some due process protections as well. A right to a grand jury is another example of something we're going to look into, and while the process we end up on might not be exactly equal to a grand jury, it's something that we have talked about and considered. In some cases, we don't have to mirror exactly civilian law, but we want to have a reasonable facsimile to satisfy Alaska constitutional protections. And perhaps, I don't know if Deputy Commissioner Dole has other specific examples. So the short example, or the short answer is, we are going to continue looking into where the U.S. Constitution has those unique protections.
But what I'm trying to get at is, okay, on the federal level, is there, with respect to a jury trial, does it have to be unanimous?
No.
That doesn't need to be unanimous there.
No, ma'am. So that's one concrete example we've already addressed. You do not have the right to unanimous jury verdict at the federal level. We have decided that to comport with the Alaska Constitution, our service members will have the right to a unanimous decision by the panel, which is equivalent to a jury.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Greenberg, then Representative Tuck, then Representative Hughes.
I'd like to explore with you the interplay and how particularly the Commission on Military, what's it called?
Military Appeals Commission.
Military Appeals Commission. Okay, I'll call it MAC for short. How the MAC sets up This brings us into something that the federal government has faced. Courts that are constituted under Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution versus courts that are created by Congress, and they're quite different constitutionally. They're called Article 1 courts. We've had quasi-judicial bodies before, various ones, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, various things like that, I think. But are you considering, and I'm going to call it Article 1 versus Article 3, legislatively created as opposed to constitutionally created, and like, among other things, whether the rules, the court rules will apply. Are these quasi-court rules that have the effect or something that will require anything, a two-thirds vote to establish them and change them? And I don't want to go into the weeds on this because this is a big issue, but in very brief sense, maybe to acquaint the people on the committee who aren't lawyers with what we're talking about here and the public. Is there an issue here? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, we will look and examine carefully the administrative law provisions in Alaska, which I think with our boards and commissions capture what is required in that context, and we will use that and shape that for our recommendations in working with the legislature on the way to go forward on that. Frankly, that's one of the areas where Lieutenant Dunbar has his research cut out for him, along with Ledge Council, in going forward on that. But we are going, that is one of the areas in terms of laying out those rules of procedure to make sure we meet all the requirements that we need further research on.
And also, Representative Greenberg, through the chair, we expect to work with the court system and the not just for the issue you've raised, but and the Bar Association, and we've been in consultation already with people at the Bar Association about getting the necessary bar rules if they're required to make sure we can have attorneys practice in front of the court martial and in front of this commission. So there certainly will be a lot of those kind of issues, I think, that arise, and we hope to work not just with the legislature but also with the court system and the Bar Association.
May I please follow up?
If it's a follow-up. If it's a new question, I'm going to go around the table.
Yes, in this area. There's a provision in here. It's on page 31, lines 9 and 10. And this relates to the MAC mission. And it says that the regulations adopted under that section, which is 2605-538, involving regulations to govern appellate procedures, must be approved by the governor, but are exempt from the Administrative Procedures Act. I assume the Administrative Procedures Act is generally going to cover other procedures here. First, that's my first question.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, actually no. Many of the procedural regulations that are asked for or that are mandated by the first part of this bill are exempt from the APA. However, with regard to the MAC in particular, the legislature does retain some oversight, for example, in that it must vote to confirm the people who serve on the commission. But in Article 2, or Section, I believe it's Article 2 of this provision, it explicitly exempts many of these regulations from the Administrative Procedures Act.
I want to look at that, too. Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I got to piggyback on that one real quick. So what would you do differently in your Administrative Procedure Act? Are you still under the Administrative Procedure Act? I'm confused here for a second.
So I believe if you look at the exact provision here, page 4, line 1, line 1 and 2, it states that the regulations adopted under this section are exempt from the Administrative Procedures Act. And that is applicable to a majority of the substantive regulations that we will be adopting, like what the offenses are and the nonjudicial punishment, for example. There is still oversight from the governor, can obviously approve or disapprove of these regulations, but they are in this statute exempted from the Administrative Procedures Act, and yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just looking at Section 2, we have at the beginning of this, regulations adopting the Code of Military Justice, just previous page, page 3, lines 1 and 2 there, says the Adjutant General shall, by regulation, adopt the Code of Military Justice.
Yes.
It says shall. And I just happen to be going through the back pages here, just looking to see how much time we have when the effective date goes into this. And on page 37, bottom 37, going into page 38, the last page of the bill, we have section 12, and it's adding a new section here, the transition regulations. The Adjutant General may adopt regulations to implement AS 2605-380, which is that section that I just mentioned. So I think there might be an amendment there that we need to change this language from may to shall.
Representative Tuck, to the chair, I believe you are correct. I believe that's probably a drafting error.
And if I may, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay, so, going back to the Administrative Procedure Act. So we have an Administrative Procedure Act now. This CS, under that section, Section 2, I believe it is, we are excluding them from the Procedure Act. I still was just wondering, you see it like following in line with what we already have, or what may become different, or what would make it unique?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I think the hope here is that we can quickly adopt a military code that will be created by the Adjutant General and then approved by the governor, and will allow us to.
I got it. Okay. Thank you. And I don't mean to interrupt you. I see what we're doing here. I was confused. I thought that was the appellate procedure. So I got things confused. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, I just have another different kind of question, because we're a little bit familiar, not being the military, not fully, but have heard of the conduct unbecoming of an officer, and understand that it, at least for active duty, and I have a son who's been an officer, and we've seen things in movies and things like that, where it carries beyond their normal day-to-day when they're in with their units, and it even in their personal life, or they take a vacation, they can't fraternize with those certain ones that are in the military. There are all those rules carry through outside the, when they have a uniform on, is my understanding. So I'm wondering, when you've got guardsmen and women who are just on the weekend, then this code would apply to them when they're not in uniform. Is that correct?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, yes. You are a soldier or an airman, an officer, 24/7. And certainly, there are certain rules that apply only when you're on duty. For example, you can't be intoxicated on duty, for example. It doesn't mean you can never drink at any point in your life. But in general, yes, we are held to these standards, whether we are currently in our uniform or not. And okay, he has a lot more active duty experience than I do. So, but that is the upshot of these regulations, yes.
Okay, thank you. Just as a follow-up, that it just makes it a little more far-reaching, and I thought that was the case, but I thought that it's important for us to understand that, because when someone is only doing a weekend, a month, or whatever, but the rest of that month, this applies, it's
yes.
Pretty far-reaching. Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when you said in the fiscal note that we have two court-martials a year, that's on the high end of things. It's typically, you looked at other states, and typically there's only one
court-martial a year, and you said it usually go pretty swiftly, pretty quick?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, that is our best estimate. There are some other states where sometimes you'll have a number of court-martials in a year. It might be the case that we initially have more, and then we get to sort of pull that back as we clean up some behavior. But in general, in Oregon and Washington are the two states that we reached out to and asked directly, how many of these do you do? And they have much larger guards than we do, and yet they nevertheless had less than one per year. So we do believe these are less frequent events, and two is... we think is our best estimate, but we hope that number will also come down.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I may ask another one.
Follow up.
Excuse me, new one, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I got mixed up in my head with the regulations and the exemption. But now looking at the Military Appeals Commission, are you guys on the page 29 that goes over to, looks like page 31, well, we still have those regulations, that last section there says the Administrative Procedure Act would be exempt from that. But anyway, the question I have is have you got a chance to look over that, and is this satisfactory to you?
We do anticipate that there might be some changes to this. I'm sorry, Representative Tuck, through the chair. There may be some changes to this language over the interim. We will work closely with Representative Ledoux's office and other offices on this. For example, so one of the key points to remember in all of this is that the Alaska National Guard is a small organization with relatively few resources when it comes to particularly legal resources. So we are interested in expanding the pool of people that can serve as judge advocates, for example. That doesn't mean they're not certified. It means that they perhaps serve in a guard of another state, or they serve on the active duty component, for example, USARAC, and the active duty Air Force and Army here in Alaska probably has the biggest pool of potential resources. So if we were to alter this language, that is one thing we have discussed, is trying to expand the number of people who could potentially serve on this commission. As it is now, the requirements are fairly stringent, and it might be that we decide to keep that, but if we were going to make a change, it would probably be to allow a wider pool of Alaskans to serve on the commission.
Okay, if I follow up, Madam Chair. So on this, this is the commission. The commission isn't necessary. Is that the appeals? Is that the appeals commission? Okay. And is that the same as the court-martial court, or is that after we go through the court-martial court, they come to this appeals commission?
Representative Tuck, from the chair, it's the latter. It's best thought as an appeals court. So think of the court-martial as a trial court. The Military Appeals Commission as an appellate court, and then the last appeal of right will be to the last time the soldier has the right to appeal will be to the Alaska Court of Appeals.
And Madam Chair, can you point me to where we determine who is going to be on the court, the trial portion of that?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, page 30. Starting line 5.
No, I mean the court-martial court.
Oh, I apologize. Oh, no, so, right. So this is, perhaps this is why you've brought this up, Representative Tuck. So your bill had that. Who may serve? Is that, you mean, who was qualified
to serve? There was a definition of somebody's right.
There was. That did not come across. So we did define who can be a military judge, who can be a judge advocate, who can actually serve as a panel member, was in HB 121. It didn't get pulled across into HB 126, and frankly, that was mostly not oversight on my part. So I will work with Representative Ledoux's office over the summer to determine whether we want to put that in statute or leave it in regulation.
Okay, and Madam Chair, if I may follow up on that. The reason why I was asking, because I wasn't sure if we had everything all figured out in our bill. And one of the things I was looking at to see if we had those corrections in the CS version is conflict. Anytime there might be a conflict of interest or a where a person may not be impartial. How are we going to handle that and where that definition lies? So I guess since it's not in this bill right now, if you don't mind, I would like to work with you guys to try to help you
come up
with language on it and help and with the judiciary chair.
And thank you, Representative Tuck, through the chair. There are some provisions in here about, for example, you cannot act as a judge advocate if you've been an investigating officer and things of that nature. But you're right that, that we have to be very careful to prevent conflicts, and it's another reason why we want to expand the people who can serve as defense counsel and trial counsel, because our small, very small, legal team in the Alaska Guard very quickly gets conflicted out of these cases. So, for example, the most high-profile administrative separations we just had over the summer were related to the behavior of our guardsmen in the last several years. All of the defense attorneys in those cases were from out of state. They were guardsmen and women from other state guards because basically all of our JAGs were conflicted.
So I was just wondering if you could give us some examples of what kind of conduct would be actionable for a guardsman who is not a full-time guardsman. And let's say they just work one weekend a month and for something that they've done for the 28 days that they are not in the guard.
Madam Chairman, the regulations have not been drafted and approved yet, so I cannot kind of bind the executive branch on this. But
I understand. But what sort of things are you thinking about, though?
If I were to look at something, for instance, somebody on a social media page who mentions their military affiliation in conjunction with making a hateful comment based on race, ethnicity, or gender, or a threatening one, and also mentioning their military affiliation in there, I think would probably be a compelling case to do it, or where they otherwise you take inappropriate actions towards other part-time members of the military that aren't sanctionable in court but threatening or harassing to a level that isn't actionable in court but would be conduct unbecoming a guardsman, would be examples of where that would come into play.
So, and I know that the regulations have not been formulated yet, but just a hypothetical. So suppose somebody makes hateful comments on their Facebook page which regards race, religion, ethnicity, sex, whatever, and they don't mention that they are in the guard, and this is on their 28 days off. What's your gut reaction to this?
My gut reaction, this reminds me of appearing before the Seventh Circuit and with Judge Posner and messing up a question like this. Beyond that, this is one of those areas why the regulatory process needs to get in that cross-section to understand the shared expectations and also shared notice beforehand so people understand that whether or not, if they don't disclose their affiliation, they are representing the, nevertheless representing the Guard, regardless. Did you have something? But this is one that's an excellent example where we do need to engage in a more deliberate process than my gut reaction, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hughes.
Yeah, the military. The Appeals Commission has three members, and they're appointed by the governor, confirmed by the legislature. And I am not seeing terms on those. Was that something that was going to be decided by regulation?
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I believe there was some talk of terms at the end of the bill. There was talk of a 246 on page 37, section 11, 246 for initial terms, staggering the initial terms. But you're correct that the default term hasn't been decided. I think that's something we'd want to insert over the interim.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, Representative Greenberg?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there going to be any requirement that any of these judges, for example, be admitted to the Court of Military Appeals? I assume no.
Representative Greenberg, through the chair, you're referencing the federal court,
No, that is not our intention.
May I continue, please?
Go ahead.
Will they be subject to the Alaska Code of Judicial Conduct?
Through the chair, that Representative Grunberg, that's exactly one of the areas we've been discussing with the Alaska Bar Association, and we need to collaborate with the courts on to define or delineate what the professional responsibility is for those who are engaged in this process.
May I continue, please?
Go ahead.
Appointment by the governor and confirmation by the legislature, as opposed to going through the Judicial Council. Any comment?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, to be honest, though, we hadn't considered going through that, and this was the provision written by Representative Ledoux's office, and at this point, we don't feel it's necessary, but perhaps something we can discuss over the interim.
I think those are things that bear some thought.
As I pointed out, that's why we have Summers, Representative Grunberg. Do we have any further questions, Representative Tuck?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just looking at the Department of Corrections fiscal note. But I know there's areas in here where you guys are able to detain a prisoner. Do you guys have jail facilities now, or ways of being able to detain people?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, no, we do not. And that's something we will definitely work on. Although, if they are imprisoned for any significant period of time, they will go to the Department of Corrections, and that is specified in this bill. But you're right, for temporary detentions, that's something we'll have to work on over the interim, I think, that the Deputy Commissioner might. No? So, but no, at the moment, we don't have a brig. We don't have our own jail.
And then, if I may, Madam Chair, so when things happen overseas or on deployment, and you guys fall into the federal military code of justices, how do you temporarily detain?
Well, Representative Tuck, through the chair, we don't. We being the Alaska National Guard, we don't, and we don't have to. That is not our. They have criminal investigation division. They being the active duty component, they have facilities. They have. They have essentially a freestanding judicial system, which is something that we lack because we are so small. But they absolutely have means and facilities to detain people. Leavenworth, I think, is probably the most famous. There are places that if you are, again, if you are on active duty, if you're under Title 10 and subject to the federal UCMJ, that they can detain and imprison you.
Okay, and then, if I may, Madam Chair, the looking at the page 7, when you look at page line 14 and 15, where a person confined as a prisoner of the military, or the Code of Military Justice shall be confined in a civilian or military confinement facility, is that military confinement facility. So currently, if a guardsman gets themselves in trouble for whatever reason, it's usually the troopers that may arrest, and then they go just right to, could be Anchorage Jail if it's a criminal, and then on to prison if they get sentenced. Is there any way of just continuing with that type of process, or will we need military confinement facilities?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, we do not envision military confinement facilities. The military up here, when they need someone confined, do they have a memorandum of agreement with Department of Corrections to provide the services and the feds reimburse them for? There are temporary holding facilities on Jaber, Isles, and Wainwright that we may be able to utilize if absolutely necessary for a matter of hours, but we do not envision any military construction to build a holding facility of any sort.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Grunberg, then
the chair. Who's going to be admitted to practice in these tribunals? Are you going to have to be a member of the Alaska Bar or what?
Representative Gruenberg through the chair. This is one of the things that we are currently discussing with the Alaska Bar Association. Our preference is that you will not have to be admitted to the Alaska State Bar to practice in front of the court martial, that you could be a judge advocate certified by one of the for example, a judge advocate legal center and school, but be admitted to practice somewhere like Oregon or Washington and be able to come up and work in front of the court's martial. And again, this is because we are a small organization, relatively speaking, with relatively little judge advocate resources.
Through the chair.
Is that a follow-up representative?
This may work when you're an appointed counsel, but let's say I was admitted in Wyoming and was hired to come up and either defend somebody, a court-martial, or even before the MAC commission. Mm-hmm. How about then?
I Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I think our intention is still that you will be admitted to practice somewhere and duly qualified as a judge advocate, but you do not have to be admitted to the Alaska State Bar. The soldiers do have the option to hire outside civilian counsel if they so choose. That outside civilian counsel, I apologize, I misunderstood your question. That outside civilian counsel must be admitted to practice law in the state of Alaska.
The chair. Right now, if I was admitted in Delaware or whatever, and somebody wanted to hire me to defend them against the charge and, you know, they were on active duty here in Alaska against in a general court-martial situation or whatever, would I have to be specially admitted, or how does that work? Do you have to be admitted to the Bar of Alaska to practice on J. Bear to defend somebody in a general court-martial?
Commissioner might be able to speak to this, but Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, I don't believe that is the case because they are practicing in front of essentially a federal court and not practicing under the state laws of Alaska. So if you are qualified, and I believe there's a federal law that states that if you are qualified as a judge advocate federally, you can practice in front of a court martial, a federal court martial, anywhere in the country.
You'll have to explain. I don't know much about this.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, thank you. Back to the possible need for a holding facility and setting up a memorandum of agreement possibly with something at JBEAR. I just scanned the fiscal note, didn't see that in there. So is that might be something that could be done over the summer perhaps?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, we'll certainly look at that. It was considered the probability being so low because if it's something that's criminal under Alaska law, it's going to be civilian authorities who are going to determine what pretrial detention may be appropriate. We will examine over the summer what may be necessary there in terms of, and figure out what to do and how we need to supplement the note.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions at this time? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you mentioned earlier talking about discipline for those that may have inappropriate Facebook postings or internet postings, why don't we have, because I know we have regulations, why don't we have stuff like that already regulated? If you don't mind. Or do we have it already regulated?
So, Representative Tuck, through the chair, we can address those things through the first three here. So, well, not the third. We probably wouldn't. We don't have control over that. But the first two, things like letters of reprimand and administrative actions and administrative separation. But we don't believe those are sufficient. And in some cases, with administrative separation, that's probably, in many cases, perhaps too extreme. It also takes a very long time. So that is where nonjudicial punishment comes in, where we can quickly administer these punishments. Do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair? So do you already have that, inappropriate Facebook postings is, but you just don't have the meat to, but you do have that already in regulations that this is deemed poor behavior?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I believe we have orders to that effect.
through the chair, Representative Tuck, we have a means now against initiating action for an inappropriate social media posting. The challenge is there's very limited action we can do, and for a repeat offender or a more serious transgression not warranting separation is kind of that gray zone that we need this additional leg of the chair to fill in.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Well, Representative Greenberg, would you like to remove your objection so that we can actually have the bill before us?
I do.
Thank you. Okay, so at this point, I would like to open up public testimony. I don't see that we have anybody, it doesn't appear that we have anyone online for public testimony. Do we have anybody, do we have anybody online? All right. Do we have anybody in the audience who would like to publicly testify? All right. I'm going to close public testimony at this point, although it may be reopened at a later point. And open up this committee in the 5 minutes that we have left for committee discussion, and note we also have an amendment here. Representative Culver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been listening to all the legalese, and it seems like there's quite a bit of legalese to actually be done on this bill yet, and so I'll leave it to the lawyers, to you, as prime sponsor, to work with the department, maybe to kind of go over this, and then I think it would be rather cumbersome for us to roll through and tweak it line by line, but I think it would be more effective use of our time if we brought back a CS in the shape that kind of what I think the committee is looking for.
Well, at this point, there is one relatively small amendment that the has been asked for. I believe the guard. Is that correct?
Madam Chairman, yes, we worked with the Chairman Herron's office in developing this amendment, and it is a small but we think important amendment. It changes. Do you want me to describe it now, ma'am?
Actually, what I'd like someone to do is to move the amendment, and then I will object for purposes of discussion, and we can go from there. Representative Culver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number one. It's 29-LS0473/H.1, dated 3/25/15.
And I will object for purposes of discussion and ask Lieutenant Dunbar to explain the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So again, this amends several portions of the bill to expand who can be involved in this process. So, for example, who can be a judge advocate for the first portion. It's page 5, line 16. It currently states, the language there currently states, a person may not serve as a judge advocate under the Code of Military Justice unless the person is a commissioned officer of the organized militia of the state. The organized militia of the state, of course, is the Alaska National Guard. We would like to amend that language to read, a state will have an active or reserve component of the armed forces or another uniformed service of the United States. And again, the purpose of this is so that we can expand that pool of people that can work on our behalf, in this case as a judge advocate, in front of courts martial. We, again, are a small guard with relatively few resources. We want to be able to bring up guardsmen, as we have in the past, from in other contexts, from the lower 48, or reach over to the active duty components on J-Bear, on Wainwright, other places, and ask them to assist us. So that is the purpose of this amendment, is to expand that pool.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions? Representative Greenberg.
Yes. Ms. Strasbaugh, the legal counsel who drafted the amendment, accompanied it with a memorandum of March 25. I think we all have that. And she raises some important questions. And the sponsor of the amendment. Representative Herron isn't here now. With this chair's permission, I would hope that we could hold this over to see how these questions will be addressed. To hear from Representative Herron, to have you guys take a look at it, Lieutenant, and for us to think about it. I have some thoughts, but I hesitate to do something on the fly in 2 minutes.
I think that's an excellent suggestion. So keeping that in mind, thank you, Commissioner Dole. Thank you, Lieutenant Dunbar. Thank you, Mr. Brown. And thank you to the committee. And we are adjourned, and it is just about 1 minute before 3:00.